This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. This sounds okay? The volume's right? Great. Will you humor me at the beginning with a little exercise? If you can think of the decade in which you turned 10 years old, and how would you have answered this question? What is normal male spirituality that you saw in that decade when you were 10 years old? We probably don't have anybody who was 10 in the 1940s, do we? Oh, we do.
1930s.
What was normal male spirituality? What did it look like back then?
Well, everybody who was anybody in the church structure was male.
Yeah, very dominant.
They were always the ushers.
Always the ushers, even? Yeah. Okay, good. How about the 1940s?
40s, actually.
Oh, 40s, yes.
So my dad was always, I related father figure like Father God and my father, you know, so he sort of represented just that extension of caring, you know, and being in charge of my welfare.
Yeah, so is that lineage comes from God on down through fatherhood, yeah, to the children. 1950s. Anybody? Yes.
Well, I was thinking kind of devout John Wayne type, you know, somebody that was kind of strong and silent type, but you know, you could count on them and they were good hearted. Maybe they had a very quiet, deep spirituality.
Okay, more.
I couldn't hear that.
Kind of a strong, spiritual John Wayne. And if they, just a dependable kind of guy, but the spirituality was not broadcast, it was internal. Not so you wouldn't really know particularly, but it would be internal. Okay, yes.
I think an altar boy at that time in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
I would say the pastor we had was somewhere between a dictator and a tyrant.
Yeah. Okay. Father's Church. Yeah. Okay. How about anybody turned 10 in the 1960s? Okay. What a normal male spirituality look like for you then?
Not that different from what has been said. I think it was still carrying over. Not that different.
Okay. It was just about to change, wasn't it?
Just about to change. Yeah, I would say, in the 60s, it did definitely.
We were just on the edge there. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Okay, yeah.
I would agree with that. The Father's Knows Best was still very prevalent in the early part, at least. And then, to me, if I were to look at the people I considered spiritual, both in my family and in the church, it seemed to be about leadership, the aspect of God that is leadership, and also character. And trying to live into a character that was, quote-unquote, godly. Less about emotion. But then toward the end of the 60s, kind of this wave of, you know, TM and all that, that kind of came up through the teenage era.
Right, yeah, huge changes start to emerge. I'll share with you, when I turned 10 in the 60s also, and we had just come back from Norway. So I'm going to sort of deconstruct the word normal, because for me, normal was so different than probably any of you. But we lived in Norway where my dad was stationed with NATO. He was a West Pointer and we were a military family. And I mean, then I spent my whole career, 25 years, as a military chaplain. So for me, normal is very much a subculture that probably not everybody's familiar with. But we lived in a Norwegian neighborhood. The winters were incredibly long, very dark. So we were secluded. We were pretty much in our house. We didn't see a lot of other people except for when we went to church. So the male that I saw was my dad. And my dad was always dressed in his uniform, powerful kind of guy, nice as could be, solid rock, you know, very dependable. And we'd go to our Lutheran church in Oslo every Sunday, and the families were all there, and the men were there, and the moms were there, and the kids were all there, and everybody had joined the church that anybody that we knew. And it was very telling of that generation that had come through depression into World War II. They had really given up so much during a major part of their life, and they finally, in the 1950s, got to experience a little bit of prosperity and stability, and they wanted that all for their kids, right? And they joined, they were good at joining big companies where they'd get a pension, and they joined big denominations. It was a time to be civic, to be a good character person, to be a good citizen. And that's what then allowed for us as those of us who are boomers, we came along and we felt claustrophobic with all the rules as a generation. And we had been given so much safety and we've been provided for so well that we then wanted to bust loose. And then we get at the end of the 60s and into the 70s a whole new kind of spirituality going. And in the 60s, as the Beatles were on the rise, and they would do these kind of like a Pew report, they go around and ask people how important is church attendance. And the people of the parental generation would say, it's so important. 9 out of 10 would say it's so important. And then go to the colleges, and it was already only 4 out of 10 in the 60s were saying church attendance is important. So we see a lot of huge changes. We struggle with this whole thing of normal male spirituality because we don't really know what normal is. Normal doesn't mean healthy. It doesn't even mean average. If we were to do a bell curve and then start norming it out from the standard deviations, we really wouldn't know what it was because it changes with each subculture and it changes throughout each decade. What looks normal for me as a little kid in Norway was really different than when I got back to the States, and it looked so different. So it's hard to know what normal is. And it's really hard for many of us to know what male spirituality is because we may have had the best parents in the world, but that faith was usually not talked about or emoted. It was kept inside by many of our parents. So it becomes a real conundrum for all of us, I would imagine. If you've got a male in your life and you're trying to figure out what the normal male spirituality is, what do you figure it out from? It becomes a real problem. We'll see why it becomes a challenge. And we're going to look at Richard Rohr's model. How many of you have read some of his stuff? He basically takes Carl Jung's pathway of the ascent of life and the descent, and he plugs in more of a Christian spiritual base. So we're going to take a look at a lot of that and then some of the archetypes of what healthy male spirituality can look like. But I want to start with this. This is a visual that shows how we're all controlled by a grand narrative. So a grand narrative is something that guides each culture. And as the hunter tribes, the gatherers, started gathering into larger people groups, and when there were farms, and they started living in more condensed places, these narratives started to emerge that supported large groups of people. And they told stories about what it meant to be along into that empire, that kingdom, whatever it was. And they would develop these grand narratives. They were really supported well by the religious leaders. And so the religious leaders, the political leaders, they would all kind of come together to say, this is what it means to have your station in life. This is what it means for you to be a woman in our kingdom. This is what it means to be a man in our kingdom. And it's in our religion as well. The two would really come together. So those grand narratives are very controlling. They kind of tell you, this is your script. And you can either choose to comply or you can rebel. But if you comply, there are institutions that will reward you to make sure that you feel good about being a part of this group and will protect you and will provide for you. But if you rebel, we're going to get rid of you. You're an outsider, right? And then we get down to the very lowest part of the individual inside of a family. The family is, of course, the biggest institution of all time in history, of providing a grand narrative and the support around it. So powerful that, strangely enough, Jesus had to take it on. It's really shocking to go back and to read the New Testament and the Gospels and to see how the biggest challenge that Jesus and Paul had was the family. Because people were told, this is what you're supposed to do. These are our household gods. These are our values, if you will. And you're allowed to be this, but you can't step out of it. And so they had to form a whole new family, the church, that would bring in the widows, bring in the orphans, bring in the slaves, etc. But it's a very controlling narrative that every culture has, and it is supported through families, through church, etc., through practically every institution, to include police force, or for my line of work was in the military. So it's just the levels of influence that we are guided by, and it tells us whether we're on track or not, if we're an insider or an outsider. And most of us, we want to be outsiders. Doesn't feel very good, does it? So I did highlight the word authority. The root word for authority is that word author. Who gets the power to write your story? Who was it who wrote out the script they started handing to you very suddenly and probably didn't even know they were handing it to you, but your parents and the people around you were telling you, this is what it means to be a girl, to become a woman, and what you're allowed to do and belong. Or if you step outside of it, what you're going to become and how you'd be pushed out on your own. And the same is true for males. That script gets written before that boy is ever born, and it gradually gets baked into him. So I would say that the main image that we have would be the knight in shining armor. How about that for a male image? And I want you to picture medieval times, and you've got this knight who's being called up by the king to go off to war. Does he polish his own armor? Probably not. There's somebody else whose name we'll never know who did the polishing. Does he put on his own armor? Probably couldn't. Somebody had to kind of clamp him in. Could he get on his horse? Could he even get his horse? Somebody had to get the horse for him. Somebody had to put him up on there. Lots of people had to put him up on there. So by the time the knight in shining armor heads out of the gate, followed by the peasants who were lightly armed, who will never know their names, but the knight heads off. The story gets told about the knight, but there's a whole cast of characters whose names we'll never know because their stories were never written. Their story, in a sense, was you get to play a bit part. No one needs to know your name when we roll the scroll. You'll just show up as, you know, the guy who polished the armor, no name attached. That's kind of an image that we have still, don't we? Except that the knight doesn't head out with shiny armor. They head out probably with a business suit. And they don't head out on a horse, but maybe a BMW or a Lexus. And they're not going off to a battlefield, but into the marketplace, where there's a lot of competition and fighting and winning. That's the kind of imagery that we now take in for many of us who were raised as males or were raised not to be male. Let's see what we got here. There we go. So we're going to get into Richard Rohr's model, where he outlines what male spirituality could look like. I want to give you a quick caveat here. I think that in the future, we would hope that all little girls are also taught this is a possible model, not the only one, but a model for all little girls. And this was really the model for the dominant culture. So white males, this was their path. There were a whole lot of people who were not allowed to live this script. They were discouraged from it. So we would hope that this could become everyone's future model. And I say that because it's not exactly the best model in the world. So, you know, fasten your seatbelts. I think we should have them installed here. But the first half of life that Heap, Jung, and then Rohr put as age 1 through 35 is the hero's journey. I would say that number has changed. It's probably like more like 1 to 45. As I look at my kids, they're much smarter about slowing things down. They didn't get married as early or have kids when they were still kids. It slowed down, and I think it's much better for them doing it slowly. But the hero's journey is longer, I think, now, and it's good. Now, Rohr and Jung did note that not all people are going to make it. By making it is when you get to that point of after setting your goals and saying, this is who I want to be. I want to be this person and look back at my life and say, I achieved these things and I feel good about myself. That's the goal, right, for self-identity. And we go through a long path trying to make sure that we can get those things done. Check, 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 right? Not everybody makes it. So we have a lot of folks who get washed out. We're certainly seeing that with, and have seen for quite a while, alcohol, drugs, a whole bunch of things that can just get people off track. And it takes them into a different journey where they might end up in a prison system. So this is not something that's an automatic, for sure. This is something that needs tons and tons of support and guidance and resources for a person to be successful. And to get to that point where they can sit back and say, ah, I made it. I got those things done. Check, 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 check. So can I confess to you something? Is that all right? This is a safe enough place? This is going to be a podcast. So this is with risk. But I think that if I don't say it, it's really not going to, I don't think it will really illustrate the point well enough. So I was of an age and served in the military at a time where if I just showed up with clean boots and an iron uniform and did my job, I got promoted. And so I went like this. I mean, it wasn't like I was passive. It wasn't easy by any means, but I got promoted. And one rank after another coming to me. My wife, when we met in graduate school, she was by far smarter than I could ever imagine being. She edited practically every paper I ever wrote. She was amazing. And we got married, and she was the teacher. And every time we had to move, and I kept getting promoted, what happens to a teacher? Start over, yeah. Get recredited, or if you can, within that next three-year period in that new state or that new country or wherever it is. So did her progression go like this?
No.
No. So mine was going on like this. She was putting the knight on his horse. She was the one who took care of everything back at the castle. She made sure that everything was good, and she was not the star of her own life. So now we're in our 60s. I get to look back and say, wow, look at all I did. Isn't that great? Does she get to do the same?
She could.
Yeah. It kind of depends, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of depends. It's the real struggle, I think, when we look at the male-female spirituality. If the system is set up so that one person gets to be the knight and the hero and look back and say, oh, that was great, at the expense of other people in life, then we're looking at a negative spirituality. And that's the thing that can happen. It can, the storyline can be wonderful, but it can also be dehumanizing for a whole bunch of other people who didn't get to star in their life. So the goal is that we get to that point where you can say, kind of did it, live in the dream.
Where is that on your chart?
That's right here. That's when you get the self-identity. So sometimes it's called, you know, the well-formed ego, the good sense of self. And the early spiritual writers, like, I'm not talking about 1950s, not back to the Desert Fathers and Mothers, but Thomas Merton said, you know, for spiritual direction, the main thing is you make a strong assault against the person's ego. Because when it gets to that point, that ego can be so powerful that it's like an internal pharaoh. More bricks, less straw. And then the person becomes a slave to their own internal ego. And it takes over. It won't let the person relax and just enjoy. It's got to keep going. Well, anyway, for those of us who do get to the point of a self-identity, the ego can become rather inflated. We may not feel it, but if you look at, you know, other people give feedback, it's a bit much. Especially if we take personal credit for what we did and think that we put on the armor and shined it and did everything. So for those of us who get to that point, and it's an inflated ego, it really is important that God, in God's great mercy, gives us limitations so that we can no longer go on that track of an ever-inflating ego. However, how about for all the people who didn't get to build an ego? The ones who stayed at home, or every time we moved, they had to get reaccredited. And instead of going up in their career path, they just kind of leveled out. Do they have that strong, inflated ego that needs to come down? No. And that's why with spiritual models that have forgotten that a lot of women never got to that point when preachers or spiritual directors say, you know what you need? You need to be more selfless. Or you need to give up that ego. Let go. It's been a real damaging, dehumanizing, it is a form of spiritual abuse. Is that okay if I say that? But for males, for many of us, it fits. But it doesn't fit for everybody. There are a lot of people who are minority subcultures. Doesn't fit for them. They didn't get that chance to have the inflated ego. Anyway, here's what happens then. So we've hit the top there a little bit, and we hit a crisis of limitation, whatever that may be, and it forces us to then make one of three choices. And I'll kind of point that out. So if you can see on there, there's the age of descent, and there are three choices. One could be, I'm going to double down, and I'm going to try harder, and I'm going to be even more successful than I ever was. And it's kind of difficult, but Rohrer calls that the old fool. I see it in myself. I'll just use myself as an example. It was when I crossed over into midlife, and it was, you know, late 40s, suddenly I got obsessed with getting a motorcycle. Because I used to ride motorcycles when I was a teenager. I had to have a motorcycle, so I did. And I spent about 15 years riding motorcycles. For me, that's a little bit of, I hope I'm not offending anybody at the motorcycle. I'm just saying, for me, that looked a little old foolish. I finally did give up the motorcycle. And then I went to a sports car, because I also used to enjoy sports cars as a teenager. They were horrible little things, and now I could actually afford one that ran. Same with the stereo. Anyway, there's all kinds of ways to reclaim that youth, to want to take the first half of life, and then just keep extending it. And it's a shame, because there's something better that's waiting, is what Rohrer and Jung are saying. We don't have to keep doing the first half of life. Kids are usually grown and gone, bills paid. We don't have to make tons of money anymore. We can go on an adventure with God. And that's an opportunity or a choice that this model encourages all of us, especially those of us who are males, and we can choose one of two paths. One is good, the other one's not so good, but some people can get embittered, and I hear this among some of my peers. I felt it a time or two, where it just feels like they've taken our world away from us. Things are changing so quickly. Language is changing. The whole idea of what is male and female, it's not supposed to be like that on forms anymore. It should be male, female, and non-binary. And it's like, oh my gosh, they've taken our world from us. There's some people who are going to settle into that and just want to fight it, and not see that they're including more and more people, but they want to fight it, and they can become, they can go on an embittered journey that is not very satisfying, it's not very growthful for them. But the people who go on the wisdom journey are the ones who can say, yeah, let's start letting go. Called kenosis. It's the emptying out. It's what Jesus did. That was his pathway. He went from being in heaven and he got rid of everything, even to the point of dying the worst possible death, and that's about the lowest point you get, to be a death on a cross, to be an absolute failure. I mean, we worship an absolute failure when you think about what that represented, this person who was nailed to a cross naked. It's like the worst for any grand narrative, I don't care what culture it is, it's the worst. We worship a loser according to the world. He went all the way down. And then, you know, in our creed, we even say that he went down to hell. It's just this way down descent. That's how we follow Jesus, is in our descent of letting go, of taking what we have and not being so attached to it. Is everybody okay? Are the seatbelts working? Hang in there? Okay. Just want to check on morale at this point. So this is from the Dictionary of Pastoral Care and Counseling, which I just love. We've got a list of traits for the traditional male identity, and I want all of you who are women to see if you were encouraged for any of these things. How are we doing for time? We're good? Okay, good. Were any of you as women encouraged as children, little girls, for competition and conquest? How about you guys? Were you? Yeah. We were in it to win it. For those of you who are women, was self-interest ever taught to you as a virtue? Was for us guys, right? I mean, maybe not all of them. Deny the importance of feelings and deny the importance of relationships. That's a big difference between most males and females. I was definitely steeped in that. To value the marketplace over the home. Well, this is important. This is my job. I got to go and do this. You're at home. Can't you? You know, that's how it goes. To talk rather than listen. Open conflict for males is, for most of us, is considered pretty good. They're of certain generations, and behind the scenes negotiation. I think that's starting to come a little bit more, but that one I know we have some male role models who definitely want to be heard rather than to listen. So you can see the list. It's often shocking for many women to realize, oh, those values were seen as good, but when they were being raised as a woman, those were considered negative. Do you see that?
Yeah.
I think that's where we see the biggest departing of the two ways for the spiritual emotional journey for males and females. And it starts really early, doesn't it? Really, really early. So as we look at males, and I would say this is going to be true for females in the future, and hopefully even now. There are some things we need to pay attention to. And I'm going to use an example from Parker Palmer. So Parker Palmer has written a book called The Active Life. He was one of those early first half of life people who embraced spirituality and mysticism, contemplative prayer. The role model for those of us who did that in the first half of life was Thomas Merton. And we read the New Testament and Jesus and St. Paul. We had St. Francis, we had all the heroes of the faith, it seemed. Were any of them married?
If they were, they didn't tell us.
If they were, they didn't tell us, that's right, yes. So we didn't get the role model of to be a male spiritual person in the first half of life, that it was okay to be in the family. It was like, this was second best. This was the B team. It was okay, but it wasn't the main thing. We were just normal, average. We weren't going on the hero's journey of the spiritual life. So we do get, I get as a spiritual director, some of the younger males now who have that calling, that bug of the spiritual life in the first half of life, and they have real trouble with just settling down into the family and embracing that average, daily, quotidian stuff. I'm the biggest offender. I had this huge mystical experience at age 18. And before that, I didn't care that much about God. I mean, I went to church because the parents took us. But after that, I was obsessed. I wanted to learn everything I could to try to figure this thing out that had happened to me. And I had my Thomas Merton, all my examples. And I just kept wanting to go off on retreats and do contemplative prayer. Let me add one thing. I met a woman I fell in love with, and we got married, and we had kids. Ladies, want to give me some feedback on how that went when I headed off to a contemplative retreat and she was home with the kids? Yes, maybe even worse, because it was harder for her to take on and go, you know, God, I mean, God's going on this spiritual journey. So she had to really kind of stuff this stuff. And, so that was a real challenge. And it was much later that I realized, when we look at actual spiritual growth, there's far more spiritual growth that I experienced changing dirty diapers than sitting for 20 minutes on a cushion. Just gotta say. Yeah. So, you know, if something's gonna really put the ego in its proper place, that horrible diaper does it a lot more than being the hero on the cushion and everybody thinks, oh, how spiritual he is. So I do, in working with young males particularly, that first half of life, it's like, go ahead, build your life. Embrace it. If you're called to have family, to have kids, that's where your prayer is. That's your spiritual practice, your discipline. And get into it. Get into your work. Be a success. I can say this to women as well. But for males, to build that identity, because they've got to have a self before they can give it up. So. The one thing that I found that Richard Rohr was really interesting on, we won't go into too much depth on this, but he said that sexual issues are always at the heart of masculine spirituality. That's probably true for everybody, right? For many young males, healthy, testosterone levels are a factor, and that's what I love about being 60. It's just wonderful to be able to have a clear thought now and again. We have a wonderful author here in the Austin area. Anybody know Dr. Pat Love? She's wonderful. I've been to conferences with her and read some of her articles. But she was sharing in this one. She said, as a young wife, she just didn't have that strong libido. And I'll almost paraphrase her. She said, but you know, when we did it, it was like, I got into it, it was a good idea afterwards, but it was never something that she wanted in advance. So she tried out an experiment on herself that she read about from other people. She talked her doctor into giving her some kind of, shot or cream of testosterone. And so she had 2 days' worth of just that boost in her libido. And she shared it at the conference. She said, "And suddenly I knew what it was like to be a 14-year-old boy." So this is a big issue for males, right? Because it doesn't quite match with that, Jesus and Paul and all these celibates. It's like, I don't have a role model who can really tell me how to deal with this. And that's a huge spiritual issue for males. I like this quote, and I'll just go ahead and read it because you probably can't read it from your place. "But a man without his feminine soul is easily described. His personality will move toward the outer world of things, and his head will be his control tower. He will build, explain, use, fix, manipulate, legislate, order, and play with whatever he bothers to touch, but he will not really touch it at all. For he does not know the inside of things. He has no subtlety, imagination, ability to harmonize, or live with paradox or mystery. He engineers reality instead of living it." And that just offends me so much because he actually read my soul. And that was something I've always been trying to hide. But he called me out. I don't know if he's calling anybody else out. But that's the struggle with the male identity, when we push away the feminine that's also inside of us. And so that's the goal of the second half of life, is to start to integrate in the feminine side into our masculine. It usually does take time in a crisis of limitation. In our culture, we often call it midlife. I think really it's a sense of my life no longer has meaning. And that crisis of meaning becomes a big issue. Sometimes it's the body, sometimes it's the job, sometimes it's dreams that fall apart, and often it's the family that falls apart. But the heroic efforts just no longer work. I can't do it. I don't have it. I can try harder and I make it worse. It is the time when the man can start to move from being in control of their own life to allowing God to be in control. And then we're starting to see this huge shift from an external religious or spiritual to something that's very deep that starts to go very internal. I think it follows John 12:24, that unless that the grain of wheat must die before it really bears fruit. So it's a wonderful journey, but really hard, right? I love William Bridges' work on transitions, and I think this describes not just the male transition at this time, but all the transitions that everybody goes through in life. And Bridges says, we're all somewhere in this pathway of transition. And a transition just begins with an ending. Something that we were holding on to is no longer there. Sometimes it's good it's not there, but often it's wrenched from our grasp. And we go through the grief, the loss, the shock. And then we return from the hospital or the court or wherever it was that we had to say goodbye to this important thing. And we come home to a new normal. And we go through this very long neutral zone of trying to get used to who we are now before we move into a new beginning. And that's where this is where all the spiritual growth is happening in our lives. Bridges says that the thing that we have to watch out for in our culture is that our culture discourages us from the neutral zone. It wants us to leap from the ending to the new beginning without settling down into the middle. He says that's where the spiritual growth is. That's where you're going to meet and find all the important things is in that neutral zone. So stay with it. Stay in there. And support people who are in it rather than bouncing out. Then people start something new. And that becomes the new part of their life, which then in the future they will end again. And we'll go through that, continue that process. So the new beginning for males, then, is that we help each other to transcend those traditional and stereotypical images and models of masculinity that block us from really growing. Is this coming on too loudly at times? Okay. And to help men adopt more balance of their masculine and feminine energies, to become whole persons connected to their bodies, their feelings, to others, to their environment, and with God. So we've got a great journey to be on. We're in a generation that actually now can live long enough to have a second half of life. Most of history, that first half is it. Those were our models. Now we get the chance, many of us, to go into this amazing new part of life, and it's wonderful. So we go back to Rohr's model, and we hit that self-identity, we're feeling good, we hit a crisis of limitation, and then hopefully we'll have people around us will say, you know, you don't have to continue on that journey. You don't have to redo the first half of life in order to be okay in our eyes. You're allowed to start letting go. You don't have to pull the cart. We can do this together. So okay, let's go back to that. Because that's really important. Thanks for bringing that up. The holy fool is, later on, he'll call it the wise man also. But it's the man who now can integrate the feminine side, can become really good at listening, can be very generous, because it's not so up to him then to have a huge amount of power and wealth that's stashed away, that says, this is who I am, I've got this. The holy fool just doesn't have to identify with that anymore. He can start to let it go. I think it's kind of Franciscan, because St. Francis showed up to the Pope, and the Pope wanted him to join the Benedictines. And Francis said, no, I want to be a new kind of fool for God. And he's the model for just letting go and just not following that journey. And he had really followed this journey. He was the son of a very wealthy merchant, and he had lots of money, and he could have just inherited dad's business. But he wanted to go on a little bit more. He was, merchants weren't nobility, and he wanted to go up to nobility. So he thought the pathway was to be a knight, and if he was a knight, then he might become a lower noble, marry a noble woman, and have, build it up that way. And he went off to war, and he didn't do well. He was taken prisoner. He was a POW, probably had PTSD, and he came back, and he tried again to do that hero's journey, and then he just realized he couldn't do it anymore. And he went into a long period of hiding out in caves around Assisi, and then going to these little chapels that were dilapidated. So he went into this descent, and he let go of everything. So finally, it was the real letting go when his dad confronted him because he had stolen a bale of cloth from his dad's warehouse because he wanted to build a church and he needed to buy building materials. So his dad confronted him in front of the bishop, and Francis took off all of his clothes. You know the story? Took off all his clothes and handed them to his dad and said, I owe you nothing, and I will only call God my father. Really harsh moment. But that, Francis was the holy fool, the one who just let it all go. And it's just amazing. So we've got a few minutes to look a little bit more at these pathways. So, as I mentioned before, some men don't accept the invitation to descent, and they'll continue to try to live out the first half of life. And it's sad, because it's not all they can be. My dad had a real hard time with not being a colonel. And when he retired, it felt pretty good for him. They used to give out, Department of Defense gave out these little eagle things that you put on a bumper and go through the gate and get saluted. And he loved going through that. And then, terrorism, you don't want to put a star or some kind of rank on your car. So they stopped giving those out, and that's when he would no longer come up to Fort Hood. He did go through the descent later on in his life, though. He had Parkinson's, and I saw him go through all the descent through that. That's the full self-emptying experience. But it took a while, and it does for all of us, right? There's some things we're going to try to hold on to. I think the last thing I will point out, that for all of us, it's hard to grieve, to let go, and yet the spiritual discipline for the second half of life is to let go, and to be able to say goodbye to things that at one point in our life were so important, but to be able to just let it go, knowing that God's got something far greater for us. And if our hands are free, we can receive the new gift, but if we're holding on too tightly to something else, then we can't receive these new gifts. Just going to give you some snapshots of the archetypes for healthy male spirituality that some of you may have heard about, but there are four that are identified. There's probably many more than that. The king, the lover, the magician, and the warrior. And we'll just end with these snapshots. So for healthy male spirituality, are you okay with me making that shift from normal to now healthy? Healthy male spirituality. The person who has lots of resources, who's been very successful, so it's not just financial, it's experience, it's wisdom, knowledge, that person now has a lot to give and to provide for others. And there's a spirituality in that that's very healthy for the person of that stage to be able to look around and say, there are other people who didn't get to do that ascent. Maybe they're from a marginalized community. Maybe they were kept down in other ways. I can help now. And that's healthy male spirituality, is to be able to see those who are starting a couple of laps behind in the race, and to start to help them up into a place where they too can have a life of achievement and feeling good and strong, healthy ego. There's also the lover. That's a wonderful male spirituality of the person who gets to the point in life where they can just enjoy and receive life as this wonderful gift. When food tastes so good, when the music of birds and the natural background noise of our life becomes a soundtrack that we want to listen to. When being in relationships with people can be just this wonderful thing. When holding those grandchildren becomes a holy experience. This is a male spirituality that's incredibly healthy. And people around those people feel really appreciated and affirmed and loved. And it's a wonderful snapshot. The magician is that spiritual leader who basically has gone through it themselves. They didn't just go and learn about religion and then tell everybody, I'm an expert, this is what you need to know. This is the person who's gone on a mystical journey. The hero's journey of descent has really made contact and can come back and start to teach other people. These are some things that really help. This would be Thomas Merton, perhaps. And then the warrior. I was trained as a warrior. Many of you probably did too. I mean, I always had a pistol in my hand, you know, a little cap gun, playing around with it. If I went outside before age 5, I always had a gun with me. I was raised with TV shows and warriors. I went into the military to continue in that path. I was a chaplain, a different kind of warrior for sure. Bear arms. But I know what that warrior spirit is. And I don't ever want to say something to think that it's wrong. Because there's something about those who put their lives on the line and are willing to do it for other people that I still admire. I see it in the firefighters. I see it in police. I see it in all kinds of people. It's a warrior spirit. And it shows up even with people who are protesting the system. They're as much warriors as any of the rest. It's that ability to put their life on the line for something, to believe in a cause. So there's all kinds of really wonderful male spirituality. And we will finish now with this quote of the holy wise man. He has experienced it all, youth and age, masculinity and femininity, health and sickness, good and evil, society and solitude, trial and failure, feast and famine, activity and silence, life and death, and now he can put it all together in a meaningful whole, both for himself and for anyone who seeks his wisdom. And that's, I think, the goal that we could say that's the holy wise man and the holy woman. We're all headed to the same place. We may have started in different ways, been shaped differently, but this is where we're all headed. I think that's that our time. I think we're finishing our time.
You can take questions from people who don't need to
go. Okay, sure. Are there any questions, comments, reactions? Yes.
It seems like somewhere in there that you have to surrender your ego. That's a big part of all of this.
Yes, yes. You mentioned that somewhere in there you have to surrender your ego. So the first phase is building an ego, and then the second phase is the surrendering of it and going down, the descent, yeah. Other comments or questions? So thank you all for being great.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.